From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
Poland proposes building a Fort Trump, and we're going to take a closer look at what deterrence really means in the cyber age. Welcome to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I'm Joseph Sternberg, a member of the Journal editorial board in London. And I'm in for Mary Kissel again, who is still safely ensconced in her secure, undisclosed location on leave. I'm joined today in our luxury podcasting studio on the banks of the River Thames by my friend and Journal op-ed contributor extraordinaire Elizabeth Braw. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, and thank you for that very generous introduction.
Well, readers are going to recognize your name from our op-ed pages in recent years because you are one of our go-to writers for explaining transatlantic security ties. You have written for us on vexing questions ranging from NATO funding, military capabilities, the like. You've also got a new project launching at the Royal United Services Institute here in London, which is one of the UK's premier foreign policy think tanks, and that project is on modern deterrence, which is something we'll talk a bit more about in a few minutes. But since we do have the good fortune of having a NATO security expert in the studio today, I thought that we should start in Washington talking about this Fort Trump idea, because Poland's president, Andrzej Duda, has been visiting Washington this week, has again floated this idea that we have heard a bit more from Poland about in recent months, about the idea of putting a permanent U.S. base on Polish soil. They are even proposing to name it after President Trump, maybe to try to grease the wheels on this a little bit in Washington. And that, is raising an interesting question, first off, about what's going on with this Polish proposal specifically, and then also just what we know about, how transatlantic ties and especially the NATO issue is evolving under President Trump. So, I mean, maybe the place to start is with this fort. Can you give us a clearer idea of exactly what this idea is and whether it's any good?
Yeah, so credit to the Polish government for some very clever branding. They've been wanting a permanent U.S. military presence in Poland now for a while. But how do you get that? It's essentially Poland asking the U.S. to help. And so far, they haven't gotten very far. But now they are more open about wanting it. And so President Duda came up with maybe not in the spirit of the moment, but came up with this idea of naming it after Trump. And one must say, it's not often that you have a U.S. president who has made a career in real estate licensing buildings around the world to carry his name. So this is very clever of the Poles. Now, the question is, will the president agree to it? Is it a fabulous deal? And it seems that he's open to it. And so what then comes next is the question, where would those soldiers come from and how would it be financed after that initial $2 billion or euro investment that the Poles are willing to make? And that's the larger question. And then on top of that, we have the question of, would all the other member states of NATO like the idea as much as the Poles do? It's understandable the Poles want it, but what about Italy, Portugal, Spain, do they also think it's a good idea to have a new U.S. military base very near Russia?
I feel like we need to put this context in this discussion in its broader context, because I think that my sense certainly in recent years especially has been that members of NATO in general are becoming more aware of new threats coming from the east, particularly after Russia's activities in Georgia and Crimea and Ukraine. My impression is that there is a general understanding that NATO needs to do more to try to deter that kind of Russian activity. Really the question is this kind of new permanent base built right in NATO's eastern edge the best way to do that? Because there are other options. They've been exploring things like rotating forces in and out so that you have a presence there, but it isn't quite as provocative as a permanent base would be. So maybe one way of phrasing this question is, what is the right mix between actions that would be very strong but also might be provocative versus other options that are effective at deterring a threat but can also help manage some of these other diplomatic issues that come up with Russia?
Yes, that's exactly right. And it starts with the NATO-Russia Founding Act from the 90s, where both sides agreed essentially to behave and have a minimum level of confidence-building measures. So Russia agreed not to be aggressive. NATO promised not to build any permanent structures in former Warsaw Pact states. And you might say this is building a base in Poland would be a violation of the NATO-Russia Founding Act. But then the other argument is that Russia has already violated it anyway. So the question is, as you said, what is the right balance between reassurance or deterrence and provocation, essentially? And so with a permanent base, it would be reassuring, and it would be an instrument of deterrence towards Russia. But would it be too much deterrence to the point where Russia says, well, hang on a second, this is too far. Now we're going to react to this. And Ben Hodges, the recently departed commander of U.S. Army Europe, has a good point, which is that permanent rotation, which is the alternative, where you bring in soldiers term after term for 6 or 9 months, something like that. You bring them in from the U.S. or wherever they are based for a shorter term in the host country. That's also a very good way of doing it, because then you practice what it's like bringing in those soldiers all the time, because that's what it would take in case of a conflict. Whereas if you have them based, if you have a certain number of soldiers based in the host country, you don't really practice getting soldiers from your home country that much. But in this case, with permanent rotation, U.S. soldiers travel in or are brought in from Texas and Colorado constantly, so that logistical chain is practiced all the time, and that's also a good system of deterrence, or a good way of deterring your adversary, in this case Russia.
I feel like this can also be a jarring debate to listen to potentially for some listeners, because it seems like only a couple months ago there were all of these headlines about whether NATO was fraying in some way, because certainly we had the regularly scheduled heads of state and government summit over the summer. Trump came in. There were a lot of arguments, about spending levels, particularly on the part of many of the European allies. That is not a new argument, but it has been taking on a greater sense of urgency under the Trump administration, because clearly Trump himself thinks that this is very important. And so, on the one hand, we have all of these concerns swirling out there about, is NATO even viable? How committed is the U.S. to that? At the same time that we've got this debate going on about whether, there should or could be some new major investment going on in a U.S. presence in Poland. I mean, what does all of this say about the current state of play on NATO or the various allies' commitment to it?
You're absolutely right. And I think the ugly reality is that we Europeans love to hate Trump. It's just that relationship is just not going to work. But the reality is that Trump, despite his aggressive rhetoric towards Europe, has increased spending on what's called the European Deterrence Initiative, which is funding on top of the Pentagon's regular budget that's dedicated specifically to increase deterrence in Europe. So that's money that is spent specifically on us and on our security, and Trump has increased that funding. So that's an example of where maybe we shouldn't pay as much attention to his words as we like to do. And what I think that illustrates, and what the Polish desire for U.S. military base illustrates, is the feeling that among most European countries that we really need the U.S. to be involved. Yes, we may hate Trump, but really, without the U.S. actively involved in European security, we are in a very poor place. And so that's why, for example, when France tried to promote PESCO as a new European defense identity, it didn't really turn out as powerful as France would have wanted, because all these countries, including Poland, essentially boiled it down to a much softer or more diluted version, and hoping to maintain good relations with the U.S., including good bilateral relations.
PESCO, that you mentioned, we should point out, is the European Union initiative to try to better organize defense spending in Europe, to have a greater cooperative angle on it. And again, I think that that's been, for me, such a fascinating example of one of these stories where at first it gets spun as Europe trying to act counter to the U.S. or create a new counterweight to NATO. And yet, once you actually start digging into the details, the idea seems to be make it possible for the European countries who are participating in this to actually invest more effectively in their own capabilities to be better members of NATO.
That's exactly right. I mean, PESCO is... it's in the eye of the beholder what it means. So to some, it may mean a European desire for more strategic autonomy. To others, it just means let's coordinate our defense procurement so that we don't duplicate each other's efforts all the time. But if I can also add, speaking of transatlantic relationships between individual countries and the U.S. Just this spring, Sweden and Finland, who can't be accused of being any Trump fans whatsoever, signed a defense agreement with the Pentagon. And I think that just illustrates how important that transatlantic link is and how much potential there is for us to cooperate with U.S. despite agreeing on Iran and what have you. There is this long history of cooperating in defense, and we have lots of officers of all ranks and ages who have done it for decades, and we have officials, civil servants. We have that long history and expertise of doing it, and it works every day despite there being political disagreements.
We've been talking about Donald Trump, NATO, and a Fort Trump in Poland, and this is Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal.
Join the Wall Street Journal at the Future of Everything Festival on May 21st to 23rd in New York City, where diverse global newsmakers share unique perspectives on navigating a changing world. Immerse yourself in live performances, explore pioneering technologies, and indulge in the city's inventive culinary scene. As a podcast listener, enjoy 20% off current ticket rates with code PODCAST. Visit wsj.com/FOEF podcast to secure your spot.
Drive time, gym time, anytime. WSJ Podcasts.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. I'm Joseph Sternberg, in for Mary Kissel, and I'm joined in the studio today by Elizabeth Brawl, one of our go-to experts on transatlantic security ties. And now I wanted to change gears in our second half to talk about your new project, Elizabeth, at the Royal United Services Institute, which is a major think tank on security issues here in London. And I think that your project is fascinating because the focus of it is the sort of thing that sounds obvious as soon as someone says it. And at that moment, you realize that this is actually an important issue that we haven't been thinking nearly enough about. So it is the focus is modern deterrence. And as I understand it, and I think you can set me straight on this in just a minute, the real question that you are asking is, how do we think about deterring security threats when we need tools other than the traditional military deterrence that we've always thought about? So, in the first half of our conversation on this podcast, we were talking about NATO, which is a very old school tool of deterrence, still very important, but, not necessarily appropriate for all of the modern threats that we see, state-sponsored cybercrime, that kind of issue. And I think that seems to really be what your project is getting at. And I thought it would be interesting to hear a bit more about, how do you start to think about an issue like this that people know is out there but doesn't really seem to have been the subject of much organized, thinking or studying yet?
Yeah, so modern deterrence, if you think about deterrence in the past, there has been our adversary has so and so many soldiers, so we need so and so many soldiers, and they'll square off, and if we have enough soldiers, our adversary won't attack us. So that's deterrence. But today, an adversary can attack the homeland, so you and me in our daily lives, without a single soldier. And it's sometimes called hybrid warfare, sometimes it has other labels, but the idea is that an adversary or enemy or competitor can use any means at his disposal to disrupt our daily lives. And that can have much more severe effects than a military invasion. So if you look at, for example, the potential of a hack of the power grid or a disruption of the satellite system that guides everything, including the ships that bring our daily goods to us because we rely on global supply chains. If an adversary attacked one of those or several, our daily life would grind to halt. We would run out of food within 24, 48 hours. We would not be able to use banks, so we would not have electricity, obviously. This is a major effect on our daily lives, and modern deterrence then means that governments can't provide national security alone because they are not in charge of all these commercial operations that you and I rely on. So they have to work with the private sector and with the wider population to team up and provide that, strengthen our defenses against such threats.
Yeah, that private sector component, I think, is what is so important in terms of the way that you're starting to think about these problems, because I think that certainly the way that ordinary people usually think about foreign threats is still very much in this mindset that a foreign threat is something that a government does that involves moving troops or, you know, a missile of some sort across a national border. And, you know, that conception of how threats operate is very bound up in the idea of the state, of the nation or the country, the governments involved in that. And yet what you're pointing at is really a model where, you know, the vulnerability lies in so many different parts of the economy. It does lie in the private companies that operate the power grid. It operates in banks, which are private companies. And, you know, certainly the solution to that can't be to just nationalize all of them in, you know, some way. So instead, there has to be some way to defend against or deter that kind of threat that will be targeting the private sector, but, you know, have the state supporting that deterrence.
That's right. And I think governments can be the coordinator in all of this. Obviously, they have their own institutions and agencies and they have armed forces, but they can also coordinate, especially companies in the strategic sector, so that they can work together with the government to provide this enhanced security. So, for example, when a company is attacked, or ideally before it's attacked, it can work with the government to, it and other companies like it can work with the government to figure out what it would do in case of an attack, so that the result is not complete chaos, which I'm afraid would be the result today, because neither the sector nor the government nor we as ordinary citizens would know what to do. And if we have that resilience within our business sectors and within the population supported by the government, then it doesn't become so appealing anymore to attack us, right? I mean, the appeal of a potential attack is that you can cause mayhem. But if you just cause a little bit of disruption, then it's not really worth the effort.
I mean, I can imagine people listening to this discussion thinking, well, I mean, it seems so obvious that that would be how people would want things to do, but it really is a big change, I think, in the way a lot of actors, especially in Western societies that are accustomed to having a clearly delineated private sector and a much smaller, less intrusive government, you know, this kind of approach to that sort of threat really requires a big change, because, I mean, what we've seen over recent years is the tendency on the part of companies, especially in, you know, cybercrime, which I think is something that most often shows up in the headlines. You know, at the beginning, I felt like there was this real tendency of companies to view it as a private internal matter within the company and only a commercial problem for them. Only slowly you know, do some of these private sector actors seem to be waking up to the fact that actually they are pieces in a much broader game of strategic chess that, you know, particularly some bad state actors around the world are engaged in, and that requires a different way of thinking about how you defend your company from the problem, and also how you respond afterward. At what point do you need to go public? At what point do you need to rope in the police authorities in your national government to, you know, look at what has happened there?
That's absolutely right. And as you said, companies have good defenses against attacks, but they see attacks as you said, commercial concern that really only matters to the company and should ideally be kept from the public limelight simply because it's embarrassing to have been successfully attacked. But if we think about, or if companies start thinking of themselves as being part of this larger picture of national security, and I think that's what needs to happen. National security is not just people wearing uniforms, but people in strategic sectors such as food, banking, transportation, energy, and even you and me. If we all start thinking of ourselves as being part of national security, then yes, it's a bit of an effort, but we are much stronger for it. And so if I may just mention an example, Denmark has been doing a pioneering work that I think can be replicated to some extent by other governments. So they have a national security coordinator who conducts, he and his team, conducts regular crisis management exercises with top executives in strategic companies so that if something were to happen, it's not just, you know, the crisis manager in such and such company responds to it. It's the CEO in coordination with the government. And then we are just in a much better place as a society. And another Danish example, you may have heard of Maersk being targeted by a ransomware attack.
The global shipping company.
That's right. The world's largest shipping company was attacked by a ransomware attack last year, I think it was recently. And for 6 days was unable to use its IC system. And you can imagine a global shipping company without a functioning, properly functioning IT system, the ships aren't going anywhere. And that's, of course, a problem for Maersk, but it's also a problem for all of us who rely on these goods that Maersk brings in every day of the year from different parts of the world.
Now, I know that you're quite early into your work in this project at RUSI, but you know, I think one interesting avenue to think about here is what does a solution to this kind of problem look like? Because I think that we will particularly as soon as you're talking about getting governments involved in collaborating or working on a solution like this, the question becomes how much is it a matter that this is really just a question of educating the particular actors and coming up with fairly flexible or informal routes of communication between the private sector and governments, just so that they know, who do I pick up the phone and call in my national government if I have a problem? Versus how much of this requires some kind of legislative solution that is perhaps a bit stronger, in other contexts maybe a little bit blunter than that kind of cooperative approach? Or, I mean, is it some mix of needing to change the legal environment at the same time that you're working on this broader form of cooperation? What does a solution look like?
Well, I think a large part of it is simply practice. So if you think of a violinist, he doesn't just pick up his instrument and play a concerto, even though he knows he has the ability to do it. He has to practice a bit every day, in fact, for years. And then when he's asked to play a concert, he just walks in and he's totally comfortable doing it because he has been practicing it. And, of course, that's what armed forces do every day, too. It's not like they expect war every day, but still they exercise every day. And so I think the same thing is possible, the same approach is possible with governments and the private sector, where you just have constant exercises involving the highest level of decision-making, both within government and the private sector, so that if something were to happen, it's just a matter of routine, that your response is just a matter of routine, then there will be, I think, some more comprehensive planning needed. So, for example, what happens if there is a really major meltdown and, for example, hospitals are in huge demand, then they have to figure out, and hospitals are often in some cases privately operated, they have to figure out what is their responsibility towards the government to handle these mass casualties, things like that. But it's not a huge change in legislation, I don't think. It's just a matter of practicing. And another example is Sweden, where there is an agency, the Civil Contingencies Agency, that does nothing but planning for these emergencies. That includes food supplies, includes healthcare, or rather casualty care, and electricity power. And So with that sort of coordinating body, you don't really need to legislate companies into changing their behavior, because it's really in their interest that we keep functioning smoothly as open societies. It's in their interest. It's in their shareholders' interest.
I mean, listening to you describe some of those solutions, I mean, one of the things that jumps out at me is this idea that actually, you know, governments and certain segments of the private sector already have a lot of experience dealing about these problems. I mean, for example, you mentioned the possibility of a mass casualty disaster interacting with the healthcare system. You know, people already are accustomed to thinking about that in terms of a terror attack. So it sounds like part of the challenge here is just to also get people thinking about how do we respond in that kind of way, if what is causing the casualties is actually some sort of problem with the transportation system that's resulting from a hacking incident, or if there's been some kind of communication problem with the ambulance network, or, you know, and any of these issues that, again, might, be creating effects that look a lot like what people are already accustomed to dealing with. But the cause, potentially because it is a, you know, actor working in an unconventional way, a cyber attack, for example, instead of a bomb going off in a crowded area, it seems like the challenge is just to train people to recognize when one of these situations is developing and to know how to respond.
That's right. The effects of any severe disruption or attack on our societies is basically the same. In the worst case, mass casualties, but disruptions to our food supplies, disruption to our electricity supply, and now these days, of course, mobile telecommunications. And so it doesn't really matter whether it's Hurricane Florence or Vladimir Putin, the effects are the same. And so that's, I think, what makes it easier to bring people in and make them be part of national security, because they've seen natural disasters. And then it's not so different if it's a Russian attack or a terrorist attack. We all need that basic training and resilience to know what to do in a crisis. And an example here in the UK is, of course, that recent terrorist attack on Westminster Bridge and in front of the Houses of Parliament, where it was really quite shocking that nobody who was milling about there had first aid training. So it took the coincidence of Tobias Elwood, who's a minister in the defense ministry, who happens to have been an officer, because he's been an officer, he had first aid training. So it took him happening to arrive at that moment to help the police officer. But what if more of us, a critical mass of us, had first aid training, general resilience training? Then it wouldn't be so attractive to try to attack us anymore, because really, you know, an attack like that wouldn't cause chaos. That would be a trained person helping the police officer, whoever else the victim was, and then we would go about our lives.
We have been talking about modern deterrence, but we're going to have to leave it there for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Elizabeth Braw of the Royal United Services Institute, for joining me in the studio today. And you can find Elizabeth on Twitter at Elizabeth Braw, all one word, and Elizabeth is spelled with an S. And you can also find me on Twitter at Joseph Sternberg, also all one word. You've been listening to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. Thanks for listening, and keep an ear out for our next podcast.